Jahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
European News Bulletin.
My name's Amina Taylor, and we are broadcasting from London. So we start with what's being dubbed V-Day. Just 10 months since the COVID-19 pandemic hit, a vaccine is being administered outside a clinical trial here in the United Kingdom. Now, this is the beginning of a mass inoculation initiative that Britain, and indeed the whole world, hope will signal the beginning of the end of this pandemic. But has the government built enough trust with the public? Bianca Rahimi finds out in this report.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened, and now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable and NHS staff have been given priority. The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation. But we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional by that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes me proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly, like the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines.
Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Well, Lembit Opik, the former MP and political commentator, is with us. And Lembit, as somebody who perhaps is still feeling the impact of COVID that you contracted just a couple weeks ago, Pfizer has been given legal protection by the government. Does that make you feel a little bit more easy in the mind?
First of all, I wish this vaccine had existed 2 months ago so that I could avoid the worst November I've had in decades. I'm recovering from the disease now, and there's no doubt if we have a successful vaccine, that's great. My concern is the one that's been expressed in your piece there. There's always going to be a risk if you rush something which is biologically significant to the human body, that you have unforeseen side effects, unforeseen circumstances which cause other problems. Now, what's the balance here? In reality, I think it's probably better that they do this, but let's recognize there's a political dimension here as well. Britain wanted to be the first in the world to implement the vaccine. They've achieved that with 800,000 vaccines being rolled out now. But there is still that small risk. I think it's probably a risk worth taking.
Now, of course, they won't be mandatory at the moment, but things like traveling and other essential elements of life might require a vaccine passport. What are your thoughts on that?
In the short term, it makes sense if you want to limit the impact not just of people coming into the United Kingdom with the disease, but also people going from the United Kingdom, which is a very high disease risk area in terms of the world at the moment, so that we don't spread it to other countries. So in that sense, having a vaccine passport makes sense. But once again, I'm concerned about the long-term implications here. Britons have given away a lot of freedom, voluntarily by and large, because they've been good corporate citizens, they've wanted to prevent death. But these precedents, if they become rather more restrictive, we could end up in a country where we have biological authoritarianism, where the vaccines become mandatory, you can't travel if you haven't got one. Then we begin to have a civil liberties debate, not one for tonight, but it's one we will certainly return to if this is used as a precedent outside this pandemic.
So will a beleaguered Boris Johnson be breathing a bit easier tonight, Lembit?
He will be, but he ought to be a bit careful here. A recent YouGov poll puts him at having 34% approval ratings and 58% against him. His party is level pegging with the Labour Party, very close together. He needs this to work. The truth is, Amina, that if this vaccine shows a massive decline in the disease, he'll get the benefit from that. But it's also, in some ways, a junk bond. The value of his credibility can go down as well as up. And if there is some terrible byproduct of this, which causes different infections, then he'll get hurt by it. He's had to put all his eggs in this basket. The country didn't want to go into 2021 with no hope. But frankly, his political fortunes are probably absolutely intimately connected with the success of this and the other vaccines. That means he's actually handed his future to pharmaceuticals.
Indeed, Lembit Opik, thank you, as always. Now we move on to the European Union, where they've rejected the results of Venezuela's parliamentary elections. This saw the President Nicolas Maduro's political alliance win some 67% of the seats. More than 14,000 candidates representing 100 or so political parties took part in the election, despite opposition parties, including U.S.-backed Juan Guaido, the former leader of the National Assembly, boycotting the vote. Now, the statement falls in line of that of Washington's. They've also rejected the elections, despite no attempt to concur with international regulators and observers. Western powers are keen to overthrow the socialist government of Nicolas Maduro and have attempted three unsuccessful coups in the past year. Now with us, Isaac Bigio, the political commentator. He's with here for his reactions. Isaac, hi. You surprised by the EU stance here and that it so clearly mirrors that of Washington?
Well, because the European Union has been following what the United States is doing, and perhaps one person can think, oh, now we are seeing that Donald Trump is accusing his own system as fraudulent, and that even Chavez, after being dead, has been able to manipulate the results against him, that the European Union could change. They didn't change. The same day as Venezuela had elections, Romania had elections, and they also had one-third of electors to participate. So the same as Venezuela, but they don't criticize Romania, they only criticize Venezuela. Some European elections have less participation than in Venezuela. Most of the local elections in the United Kingdom and many parliamentarian by-elections have one-third or less of participation, but they don't accuse that of fraudulent. In the Venezuelan election, we have more than 100 parties, most of them from the opposition. You have different right-wing opposition and even a left-wing opposition. But I think that the European Union is always going to follow what Washington says.
And very briefly on this one, Isaac, the U.S., we know, has directly backed multiple coups in just a matter of the last 18 months or so. How can they talk about free and fair polls?
Have you seen Donald Trump accusing his own system as fraudulent? The United States has supported every single dictatorship in Latin America in the last 70 years. None of them has been punished by the Organization of American States. But in Venezuela, they removed the Venezuela from the Organization of American States. They recognized Guaido, a guy that had never been elected by anybody. He couldn't stand in this election because he was not going to have any single vote. In Catalonia, they rejected a referendum organized by the Catalan government,
indeed,
despite that 40% of the population vote. But now in Venezuela, they reject a national election, and they wanted to implement a referendum which nobody is going to vote. I think that is a double standard. When they want somebody to be punished because this government is against the United States,
indeed,
they will punish the government. If it is a government that supports the United States, they will follow that route.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thank you, as always. Now we move on to Britain here, where the country's Prime Minister Boris Johnson has labelled the latest rounds of Brexit talks as difficult, further adding that the UK would have to decide very soon if there was indeed going to be a no-deal Brexit. With just over 3 weeks before Britain completes its journey out of the bloc, significant differences still remain over trade, state aid and fisheries. And if an agreement is not reached by the 31st of December, the UK and the EU could introduce import charges on each other's goods. Prime Minister Johnson's comments comes just a day after he and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen spoke on the phone and agreed significant differences on key issues remained. The pair have scheduled to meet in person in the next, quote, coming days.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, Priti Patel, Britain's Home Secretary. Well, is she covering herself in some more glory there?
Well, I mean, we're learning now, Amina, just days after the UK Home Office and Priti Patel went ahead with a number of deportations. The deportees, we believe, were directly related to the Windrush family. Of course, that was a scandal in itself, erupting 2 years ago. And now, just days after this, we find that the Home Office is set for another round of deportations of potential asylum seekers. And invariably, this has raised massive concerns to human rights lawyers and also watchdogs, who are saying that, you know, the government is going to come out with their usual line saying these people must be deported for X, Y, and Z. But experts are actually saying there are potentially people targeted by this move who themselves have been victims of trafficking, human trafficking, and other serious crimes, and they need to have their case further looked at before this decision can be made. In some ways, this doesn't surprise us, but of course, you know, we've become used to this kind of move from the Home Office, but human rights campaigners are understandably furious at the proposals, Amina.
And has this sentiment been reflected in the online reaction?
It certainly has. A lot of people keeping ahead of this issue now. John Brady says, I see Priti Patel is rushing the deportation of asylum seekers to beat the Brexit deadline. This includes people suspected to have been trafficked into the UK. This is the same Priti Patel who said, let the Irish starve during discussions on the impact of Brexit on food supplies. And we have a reaction from Andrea who says, men and women in Brexit Britain are unjustly detained and unlawfully deported. Windrush children suffer the deportation of their parents. The ethical and moral fabric of this country is deteriorating under government threats.
Well, I guess that's what they meant when they say take back control. To your other story now, unfortunately, Richard, whenever we speak, there seems to be just another tragedy. This time, once more, coming out of the United States and the killing of another unarmed black man.
Another day and another black man dead at the hands of law enforcement, Amina. This time, 23-year-old Casey Goodson, who was shot in Ohio on Friday. Now, almost predictably, the police allege in their account of events that Casey Goodson was holding a gun. But get this, Amina. Casey's own family say he wasn't holding a gun. He was holding a sandwich, and he was actually shot three times in the back whilst entering his own home in front of his grandmother and also a sibling, you know, a child. And, you know, quite apart from the fact that Casey Goodson has had his life taken from him, I can't really imagine the trauma this would have sparked with his family. It's an almost unbelievable state of events. There's been a lot of celebration in recent weeks, you know, at the back of Donald Trump, as if this is the back of racism. But, I mean, if ever
we're
there
clearly
were...
clearly seeing that that's not the case at the moment, or perhaps it's just intensifying feelings in these volatile weeks before the inauguration. Can we move on to the social media reaction on this?
Sure, let's go to Stance Grounded, who says, Ohio police killed a 23-year-old black man who was walking into his own home with a Subway sandwich. Casey Goodson Jr., the police claim he was waving a gun, but he had a concealed carry license and the police shot him in the back. And Moonzy, also on Twitter, says, his name is Casey Goodson. He was just 23 and he was unjustly taken from his family and from the world. We demand that Franklin County Sheriff's Office takes charge and arrests Deputy Jason Mead and put him under trial for murder. We will not rest until we see justice.
We might have some bad news for Moonzy here, which in many of these cases, the officer is not charged. All right, Richard Sadat, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you so much. So some other news now, where EU foreign ministers have begun evaluating grounds for sanctions against Turkey over its claims to hydrocarbon resources in the eastern Mediterranean. The EU's bloc's leaders will decide at a summit later on in the week on whether to make good on these waves of sanctions. Speaking on the East Med dispute, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Turkey would not bow to threats and blackmail from the EU over its row with Greece. The president added that any plans or maps excluding Ankara from its rights in the eastern Mediterranean Sea were unacceptable. NATO member and EU candidate, Turkey claims gas resources that are also contested by Greece and Cyprus, a dispute that has had spawned territorial rows over maritime borders. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron announced that concerns over human rights violations in Egypt would not affect the future sale of French arms to that country. Since 2015, France has sold considerable amounts of weapons to Egypt, with Macron voicing concerns that the country would turn to the West's rival, China and Russia, if it did not receive adequate support from Europe. Following Macron's press conference, over 20 human rights groups issued a statement condemning France's strategic partnership with Egypt. The statement accused Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi of human rights abuses in the country, including the cracking down of pro-democracy activists and supporters of his rival, Mohamed Morsi. Well, it seems a Saudi prince is breaking ranks when it comes to the occupation entity. Robert Inlakesh, more details, please.
Well, this is an interesting case, and it can be read in many different ways. So the statements which were made by the prince, the Saudi prince, Turki al-Faisal, of course, these are very accurate claims. He says that it's a Western colonizing power and that it operates concentration camps for Palestinians and it assassinates whoever it wants. These, are, of course, ring true to many's ears, but unfortunately, we're looking at Saudi Arabia here, which does a very similar thing in Yemen. It's a close ally of the West and, of course, Israel. We know of the first meeting officially, which just occurred between the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, Netanyahu, and also Secretary of State for the United States, Mike Pompeo. What may have happened here, it could be taken a few different ways. Number one is that it looks like Saudi Arabia are quite enraged at the fact that Netanyahu leaked the fact that this secret meeting was supposed to be secret meeting Saudi Arabia, for one. They're not quite yet ready to normalize ties with Israel. And so perhaps this is sort of pulling away from them, and it's a way of them, you know, signaling that it's not time for them to normalize ties, that they're not ready to go ahead with this. It might be a saving face thing also. And on top of that as well, people have speculated as to whether this is something to do with Iran. Do they want to be seen as such an aggressive party against Iran on the front lines for Israel? Do the Saudis want to subject themselves to possible retaliatory strikes on Saudi Arabia if they formalize ties with Israel and start allowing Israel to even use their territory to commit massacres against Iran and to strike Iranian territory? Do they want to get tangled up in that? And of course, perhaps they do not want to get tangled up in such a thing. So this can be taken many different ways. But of course,
Robert Inlakesh, there could be the idea here that there's not a uniformity of positions inside the House of Saud, that there are actually members of the royal family who thinks this is a bad idea for a variety of reasons.
Absolutely. There is a difference of opinion. Even with the UAE normalization, there's many that were against it that just didn't voice their opinions. We've heard one of the opinions voiced here. And so it does show there's a divide in opinion here. However, Saudi Arabia continues, for instance, to crack down on Palestinians, behead Palestinians, imprison Palestinians for no good reason, of course, and crack down on the Hamas movement and put out false statements about the Hamas movement. So, you know, one Saudi prince stating that. Well, the first one we've got here is from a user called David. He says he's basically saying he says all of these things while sitting at the table at a panel with Gabi Ashkenazi, who's the foreign minister for Israel. And he says, lol. And we've got another one here from an Israeli who says they will never settle with the Jewish state, maybe only for a short time when it suits their interests and if it's not public. I posted previously a photo proof of their anti-Israel training seminars, and that's interesting because, of course, there's many in Saudi Arabia that disapprove of this, and the Israelis are not friendly towards them on a general level.
And we move to your second story. Some interesting words coming out of Brussels for Tehran.
Absolutely. This one, just utter hypocrisy, trying to paint, you know, the JCPOA as an agreement where it's just an ask and deliver sort of negotiation here. They want Iran basically to hold up their side of the JCPOA when all the other sides have betrayed it. The United States unilaterally withdrew from it. Trump then slapped on these criminal sanctions, which amount to war crimes in some cases against Iran. And the Europeans have not held up their side of the bargain, and they have not gone as far as even attempting to punish Israel, not only for the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran's top scientist, but on top of that, Qasem Soleimani as well. Nothing has been done on the international stage for this. Whilst they're still doing weapons deals, for instance, with Saudi Arabia, with the Persian Gulf states, on, you know, unprecedented levels, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons flooding into that region. And they have the audacity to criticize Iran. Many are saying this is ridiculous. Israel has a stockpile of, it's estimated, about 300 nuclear weapons. They haven't signed the non-proliferation agreement. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program, and it's enriching uranium for other purposes. It's stated as such. There's no one, no body on earth which will state that Iran has a nuclear weapons program. And, of course, it's utter hypocrisy. Why wouldn't Iran even be able to obtain such a thing if it wanted to attain such a thing, for instance? This
and
is just
some very powerful responses to this claim.
The first one we have here is from Sayed Mohammed Marandi, who says, in an interview on CNN, I stress that Iran won't accept any changes to the nuclear deal. Nothing will be added or renegotiated. The report implies that this is a bluster. This is a dangerous Western miscalculation. Iran didn't resist 4 years of Trump's barbarism to appease Biden. And then we have another one here that says, fool me once, shame on you, fool me, shame on me. Why should Iran waste time, effort, to entertain a one-sided deal only from for another few terms of seesaw political pantomime that ushers in another U.S. patsy that reneges on a deal lauded by honest Western nations? No thanks.
All right, Robert Inlakesh, thank you, as always. And this is where we leave you for this evening. Until next time, stay safe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The article you're going to hear has been penned by Robert Lewis. Robert Lewis is a lawyer licensed in California. He has worked in leading US, UK, and Chinese law firms in China for nearly 30 years. The article is titled, Under Biden, US Set to Resume Globalist Policies. Stay with us for more of Robert Lewis's article. With Joe Biden's victory in the US presidential election, Donald Trump's America First doctrine will be jettisoned, and Biden will seek to return the United States to pre-Trumpian norms. That is expected to mean a return to the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and perhaps even the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Meanwhile, the challenges in the Sino-US relationship will not have magically gone away when Biden takes over, and political matters in relation to China are now so entrenched in the US that no major substantive policy changes may be possible. faith would have it, Joe Biden and his fellow Democrats again find themselves assuming power in the wake of a global economic downturn. In 2009, it was in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis. Now, it is in the midst of a renewed lockdowns across Europe and the United States. In an effort to try to stop the second wave of COVID-19 infections from overwhelming the healthcare system. It will likely take many months into the Biden administration for vaccines to bring the United States, its allies, and the other major industrialized nations and other affected parts of the world back to normal. So there are two parts to the Biden administration's goal of getting things back to normal. There is the pre-Trumpian globalist normal, and then there is the pre-pandemic normal. At some point, he and other Western leaders will have to explain why China and other parts of Asia have been back to normal since the late second quarter of 2020, while a return to normal in the United States and Europe now is not projected to occur until at least the third quarter in 2021 at the earliest. Politicians always deflect blame for problems. Donald Trump blamed China for the pandemic. Joe Biden will blame Donald Trump for any pandemic-related problems going forward. In any event, Biden will have to play the cards he has been dealt, and his performance will be measured by actual results. A key component of the global system is trade, and the system is designed to promote more open trade in order to increase global trade volumes and economic development. Donald Trump's America First doctrine is generally understood to be protectionist in nature, and thus presumably anti-trade. His use of tariffs as instruments of trade warcraft similarly has been criticized as antithetical to sound economic and trade principles. However, historical trade statistics over the last decade paint a picture that suggests that continued growth in global trade may not be directly tied to who is in the White House. During the Obama-Biden years, after a steep decline in global export trade volumes in 2009 following the global financial crisis, global exports rebounded rapidly to set new highs for a period of four consecutive years, from 2011 through to 2014, ultimately reaching a peak of $18.9 trillion in 2014. In contrast, in 2015 and 2016, global trade volumes declined by more than 15%, putting global trade levels back on par with pre-crash levels and erasing all the gains in the preceding years. Then comes along a virus. In April of this year, global trade volumes plummeted a remarkable 12.2% in just 1 month. To put this in context, from January of 2010, the monthly change in trade volume had been characterized by an alternating series of small peaks and small valleys, generally with month-on-month increases of no more than 2.5% and decreases of less than 2%. In light of the precipitous drop in trade volumes due to the pandemic, the World Trade Organization, WTO, projected in April that trade volumes were set to plunge by between 13% and an almost unimaginable 32% for the full year 2020. This dire forecast by the World Trade Organization experts failed to recognize the apparently unstoppable momentum of global trade, even in the midst of a global pandemic. In May, the monthly decline in trade volume was only 0.9%, and the June trade volumes had jumped back into the plus column, giving 7.9%, followed by smaller but still historically high rates of increase over the next 4 months. By early October, The World Trade Organization had revised its guidance to forecast an overall 9.2% decline in trade in goods for 2020, followed by a 7.2% rise in 2021. The forecast drop for 2020 is still sobering, but pales in comparison with the more than 22% decline in global trade in 2009 after the global financial crisis. The forecast 2020 drop is also smaller than the two-year decline of more than 15% in the last part of the Obama-Biden administration. Some additional historical perspective is required to more fully understand the irresistible force of global trade. Even with a modest decline from 2018, as noted above, global trade for 2019 was still up more than 350% over 1995 levels, which were $5.19 trillion, and a remarkable 6,300% higher than 1970 level of trade, which was $302.3 billion. It appears, at least so far, that not even a pandemic can stop the long-term growth of global trade. As author and columnist Zachary Carabel commented in March, "When we assess the prospects for global trade going forward in the full historical context, it would appear more plausible that the most coronavirus future will see not an end to the globalizing trend of recent decades, but a new chapter in the story." Stated otherwise, if Donald Trump and COVID-19 did not derail global trade, maybe nothing can.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أول عوض الحليم من حلمه أن الناس أنصاره على الجاهل.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The first reward the exerciser of forbearance gets is that people become his helpers against the ignorant."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's a blessing to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great lessons, dear friends, which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is this concept about being a student. It's really interesting. Many of us, if not all of us, have gone through school in one form or another, and we are all considered students. Some of us after high school or after college or university, perhaps a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, or even a doctorate degree, we then stop studying or we don't consider ourselves to be students anymore. But we learn a very interesting thing from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and that is the importance of being a student and the importance of being a student throughout our life. And not a student of, for example, the physical or chemical or biological sciences of the world, which in it of itself is nothing wrong, but to be a student of the Islamic sciences throughout our life. Now, as is evident and has been proved clearly for any and all unbiased, unprejudiced researcher, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, was superior to all human beings, and his knowledge was above all human beings as well. Now, naturally, such an intelligent individual, smart individual, knowledgeable individual, wise individual, such as the Holy Prophet Muhammad, was deserving of an excellent student who would be at the level where he could acquire all of this knowledge from the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so this is who Imam Ali alayhi salam was. As all of history has proved and has shown evidence, Imam Ali alayhi salam was the most intelligent, the most smart student who had accompanied a perfect man, the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And this student was hungry for knowledge on the one hand, and on the other hand, this student, Imam Ali, his interest in learning from childhood till the end of his life is what made Imam Ali a student a disciple of the highest capacity who was walking on a path leading to the zenith, the peak, the summit of perfection. And so, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends out there who are listening, remember that we should always be the students of Islam, and we should be the best students of Islam, just as Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us, and he has shown us that to be the best student of Islam is truly a proud achievement, a profound lesson from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالم على يدي يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger. And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet. And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi,
And this last will of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Sayyid Razi has included this in the section of Nahj al-Balagha dealing with the letters of Ali, because this was a written document. And this is letter number 47 of Nahj al-Balagha. And so this is Mustanat, as we call it. Authentic last will of Amir al-Mu'mineen, which he wanted it to be not only for his family, but for the entire Shia community, even for those who will come in the future. If you do not exercise Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy al Munkar, then evil people will be imposed on you. ثُمَّ تَدْعُونَ فَلَا يُسْتَجَابُ لَكُمْ. Then you will sit down there praying to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to get rid of the evil leaders, and Allah is not going to listen to your dua. لَا يُسْتَجَابُ لَكُمْ. He will not respond. Because he said, I gave you a system. You didn't fulfill your part of the deal. The excellence and the fazilat of Ali is that even in the most tiring situation, most difficult situation, Ali never wavers from the right path at all, from the preferred choices that Allah has put in front of him. Even at that time, Amir al-Mu'min is concerned about what will happen immediately after me. And so he has certain advice for the family now. He says, Ya Bani Abdul Muttalib. So he's not only talking about his sons or the extended family. The Rome Bani Abdul Muttalib. And it seems that everybody was there. Everybody had been gathered by Amir al-Mu'mineen. La ulfiyannakum takhudhuna dima'al muslimin khawdan. تقولون قتل أمير المؤمنين قتل أمير المؤمنين. He says, when I die, I don't want you to go in a chaotic situation finding those who are my opponents and killing them because I have been killed. Because in these kinds of situations, sometimes emotions overcome people. And so even those who are not involved in the murder of Amir al-Mu'mineen, but they were known to be the enemies, you know, sometimes, yes, those who love Ali might get excited and they will go and find anyone who was an enemy of Ali and they'll start killing. You know, the chaotic situation, the mob mentality. Ali is especially talking to his extended family. He says, I don't want to see that happening. That you go around saying, قُتِلَ أَمِيرُ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ and going after anyone who was my opponent. أَلَا لَا يُقْتَلُنَّ بِي إِلَّا قَاتِلِي. Nobody will be killed because of my death except the one who murdered me.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.